Welcome to the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, a weekly podcast for anyone interested in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry. This week's episode is sponsored by Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, a full-service regulatory compliance consulting firm serving the ambulatory surgery industry, and Eden Group Development, publisher of the ASC Regulatory Compliance series of books by John Gailey. Hello and welcome, everyone. This is the ASC Podcast with John Gailey. This is week 8. It is February 19th, 2018, and I'm your co-host, Jenna Alvarez. First, let's start with this week's news. The Joint Commission announced 3 revisions to the life safety chapter this week. The first was a clarification that non-rated doors, including corridor doors to patient care rooms and smoke barrier doors, are not subject to the annual inspection and testing requirement of either NFPA 80 or NFPA 105. This revision is applicable to ambulatory surgery centers. It is of note that those organizations using the Joint Commission for deemed status should still be routinely inspected in compliance with the organization's overall facility maintenance program. The second revision is a new requirement for ambulatory surgery centers, as well as other healthcare facilities, to manage the environment of areas in which inhaled anesthetics are administered. Specifically, heating, cooling, and ventilation must be in accordance with ASHRAE 170. And important here is the medical supply and equipment manufacturer's instructions should be considered before reducing humidity levels to those allowed by ASHRAE. Existing smoke control systems automatically vent smoke, prevent the recirculation of smoke originating from the surgical suite, and prevent the circulation of smoke entering the system intake without interfering with exhaust function. New occupancies have no smoke control requirement. Existing smoke control systems are maintained per NFPA 101-2012. The third revision is a requirement for corridor latches to ensure consistency and alignment with CMS requirements. The specific requirement varies for each applicable accreditation program. Also from Joint Commission this week, the 2018 National Patient Safety Goals have been released. Really, there don't seem to be many changes from previous years, but let's go through them real quickly. The first is to identify patients correctly, always using at least 2 patient identifiers. The second is to use medication safely. Before a procedure, label the medicines that are not labeled. Take extra care with patients who take medications to thin their blood. Record and pass along information about patients' medicines to the next provider. The third is to prevent infection. Use hand cleaning guidelines from the CDC and the World Health Organization. The fourth is to prevent mistakes in surgery, making sure that the correct surgery is done on the correct patient in the correct place on the patient's body. Making sure that the correct place on the patient's body is marked, and pause before surgery to make sure a mistake is not being made. Lastly, in news today, there was a great article in Outpatient Surgery magazine about using sign language to limit OR traffic. As we all know, the more times that an OR door is opened to ask questions, the more risk there is for surgical site infection. A simple solution was identified as using sign language. First, they identified the most frequently used questions and developed different signs to help communicate among the surgical team. The article identified the most common questions that staff members asked when they entered the ORs for non-essential reasons, such as, does anyone need help? Does anyone need a break? Then they trained staff to ask questions using sign language. Now they communicate with the surgical team through the window of the OR doors rather than walking through the doors themselves, and surgeons were pleased with fewer interruptions. What a great way to lower the risk of surgical site infections. You can read the article at outpatientsurgery.net. Okay, so those were our 3 news of the week items. John, do you have anything to add?
Thanks, Jenna. First of all, thank you and welcome to the podcast here. It's great to have you on board. Yes, there's a couple areas that I thought I would talk about. First of all, that was a great article from Outpatient Surgery Magazine. And I think we're actually going to have a little bit of an update in another episode about the importance of keeping those corridor doors open or closed during the procedures. And we have actually some research that shows a higher incidence of infections the more frequently that door is open. But back to the temperature and humidity item, that's an item that comes up quite a bit during our mock surveys and during all the work that we do and during the actual surveys that I do with the accrediting organization. So we know that we can use a categorical waiver to permit the organization to operate humidity within a 20 to 60% humidity range. However, there was clarifications from ASHRAE later that indicated that you need to look at the instructions for use for both the equipment and the supplies that are used in your operating rooms and throughout your facility. And if those instructions for use require a different humidity range, you have to follow the instructions for use. So what we're finding actually is that most of the major equipment that we use today do indeed require a humidity range between 30 and 60%. So regardless of what the rules might allow, the instructions for use will always trump that. And if we haven't mentioned this before, let's emphasize again the importance of maintaining a nice binder with all of the instructions for use for all of your equipment in your organization. Now, I'm just going to segue to a recording I did at the ASDIN conference, the American Society for Diagnostic and Interventional Nephrology. I made this recording in Salt Lake City, so it's not the highest quality, unfortunately, but we did have a great time there, and let's just listen to the comments I had from the conference.
First of all, I want to apologize to our listeners since Jenna and I are actually not together to record quite a bit of this podcast today. I'm recording this section from Salt Lake City. I'm attending the American Society of Diagnostic and Interventional Nephrologists. Their annual ASDIN conference, as it's called, is held here in Salt Lake City this weekend. And I have the privilege of being one of the speakers. I'm speaking on, or I did speak actually already when I did this recording, about ASC survey readiness. So what's happening with diagnostic interventional nephrologists with vascular access is that in 2017, a number of pretty significant cuts occurred in the dialysis vascular access services reimbursement, which are pushing many of the nephrology practices to look into new revenue sources, including the conversion of their vascular access centers, which are usually like office-based procedural facilities, into an ambulatory surgery center. So we welcome these organizations into the ambulatory surgery center fold, and they are, of course, going through all of the things that they need to learn to become an ambulatory surgery center. So I've been working with quite a number of centers across the country on this process. I actually am working with Azura, which is one of the major providers of vascular access services, in the conversion of many of their office-based practices in ambulatory surgery centers. So a substantial portion of this conference was actually dedicated to discussions about these conversions and providing participants with information about the challenges and the opportunities in that conversion. Now, in 2018, some of the reimbursement changed again. The reimbursement for the procedures that are done in the office increased slightly, about 3%, and the ambulatory surgery center reimbursement went down by about 20%. But there still is a significant gap, and it still is quite a bit more beneficial from a financial standpoint to do those procedures in the outpatient setting. And I'll make the argument, too, that it's probably a safer setting, giving all the advantages of an ambulatory surgery center over an office-based practice. So my speech was about ASC survey readiness, and we talked about the challenges of running a Medicare-certified facility compared to an office-based center. And we talked about what an organization goes through the survey process and how to be prepared, always be prepared. One of our themes here at Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies is how do we always make sure that we're ready to meet the challenges of a survey. Some centers are already accredited as an extension of their practice or as an office-based surgery or office-based procedural practice. So they're familiar with the surveys, but even those centers must really make substantial changes to meet the CMS requirements and to be prepared to be surveyed under the conditions for coverage. So this development is actually quite a good opportunity for existing surgery centers. So I encourage existing surgery centers to reach out to their friends in the vascular access area to see if it would be a good addition to offer their services in your center. Vascular access services require a C-arm, a radiation tech, and a lot of very expensive supplies. And most of these patients receive conscious sedation. Also, it's important to point out that these patients also are usually quite a bit sicker than many of the patients that we see in many of our centers. So we have to take that in consideration as we develop these programs. These procedures, however, these cases can be quite profitable if they're managed properly. So if you're an existing ambulatory surgery center, definitely think about the possibility of adding vascular access to your organization. And to all of the vascular access centers who are hopefully listening to this podcast, please stay with us as we talk more about the various aspects of running an ambulatory surgery center and the challenges that you have in always maintaining your Medicare certification.
So that concludes our new segment of the week. Let's take a quick break and then we'll be back with our scenario of the week.
So, good morning, Adele. Thank you for coming in for this interview for the administrator position at our surgery center.
It's my pleasure. I look forward to talking to you about this opportunity.
Well, as our advertisement in the newspaper indicated, this is for the administrator position here at our ASC. Our last administrator has left us in a bit of a pickle. She actually ran out the door screaming, "I can't take this anymore."
Oh my, why on earth did she do that?
Well, she was just lazy. We would give her additional administrative tasks like ordering our lunch, arranging to have our cars washed, buying presents for our wives on their birthday, and things like that. And she felt it was beneath her. We kept pointing out that she was our administrative assistant and she needed to do anything we told her to do. I assume you know what the role of an administrative assistant are and you are prepared to do them.
Wait, Dr. Jones. I thought this job was for the administrator, not the administrative assistant.
Administrator, administrative assistant, what's the difference? You just do administrative things. All she did all day long was write up minutes, fill out logs and forms, send out emails, etc.
I don't think you quite understand what an administrator in an ambulatory surgery center does. For example, I'm a certified administrator of an ASC. It's also known as CASC, which means I have passed a comprehensive test and demonstrated my experience as a professional administrator.
That's interesting. But this isn't really a full-time job, right? I mean, you can do this job as well as work other tasks, like covering in the operating room.
Well, in a small center, you might have a part-time administrator that also is involved in direct patient care, but regulatory requirements are getting such that it is harder and harder for someone to do both.
Well, that is very interesting, Adele, but I expect that the administrator should be able to take care of my dry cleaning and get my car washed, right?
You know, Dr. Jones, I don't think this position is for me after all. An interesting scenario. John, what are your thoughts?
So I have to admit, and by the way, I did write this scenario myself. This scenario is a little extreme, but I have actually witnessed a center where the doctor didn't know the difference between an administrator and the administrative assistant. We've come a long way as an industry, and the job of the administrator has really grown considerably with it. So I was an administrator in the 90s, really when the ambulatory surgery industry was just starting. And, you know, the requirements of an administrator back then were very different than they are today. We didn't have all the regulations. We didn't have the complexity of procedures that we're doing. We didn't have the large facilities like we do today. The ASC Association has worked with industry leaders to develop the CASC, which is, as was mentioned in the scenario there, the Certified Administrator Surgery Center credential, to address the growing requirements of the profession and to provide surgery center owners and governing body members with something to look to understand and know that somebody is really qualified to be an administrator. By the way, a lot of that information is available on the website for CASC at www.casc.org. www.aboutcask.org. So the CASC credential identifies the following core competency areas for administrator, and I like to use these to show what owners should expect in an administrator for their facility. So those five core competencies are financial management, quality management, regulatory and legal issues, delivery of patient care, and human resource management. Now, it's getting tougher for an administrator to do the role while covering the functions in the ASC, such as covering in a room. So those days are starting to disappear, especially in those very large organizations. Really, if you're going to do that sort of thing, you're going to have to be in a much smaller center. Even there, you will definitely have to have someone else handle the financial side, including billing, and you'll most likely have to outsource your regulatory oversight services to a company like our producing sponsor, Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. So that brings up the question here. What are the skills that are needed to be a good administrator? There is a lot of debate about whether an administrator has to be a nurse. Now, as a former administrator myself, who is not a nurse, I think you can pretty much figure out where I come in this. But a lot really depends on the size of the facility. Small centers can really benefit from a nurse administrator who is backed up by a good business office manager or a financial oversight or management service. They'll also have, most likely need to have access to some outsourced regulatory compliance services. Larger centers will probably need someone with a real broad background to be the administrator, including the knowledge of all aspects of the position, such as, what are included in what we talked about earlier, the CASC certification. So I encourage surgery center owners to look for administrator candidates that have the CAS credential or are in the process of getting certified, as this is a really good way to determine that they have the requisite technical skills for the job. So I think I just want to conclude by pointing out the importance of respecting this position of an administrator, understanding the core competencies that are required for the position, and understanding that even though a lot of the work that's being done by an administrator is not seen during the day, it is a very important function of the organization. And really, the whole point of this whole podcast that we're doing here is to provide administrators and leaders in an organization with the tools that they need in order to be on top of things. And that's nearly impossible if you are covering a room constantly, or doing the laundry, or taking care of the dry cleaning, and buying gifts for the owner's wives. So please, everyone really needs to respect this position and understand the complexity of the issues that administrators deal with on a daily basis. Okay, so let's take a short break, and we'll come back with the listener question for the week.
Sounds good.
So this week's question comes from a friend of ours in New York, Pam, who asks, what should we be doing during that six-month survey window that we have for a deemed status survey? Thank you, Pam, first of all, for the question. So Pam is referring to the approximate time frame that we're given by an accreditation organization during a deemed status survey. So first thing I want to point out, which is kind of obvious, is that we should always be prepared for a survey. So if you're always prepared, if you do a good job of making sure your organization is right up to speed with all the issues that they're going to confront during a survey, there really is no concern, or there should be no need for concern about a surveyor showing up at any point in time. But of course, this is everyone's going to be concerned about a survey. It's a fact of life. But let's interpret this question more as, how can I make sure that we are ready to fully demonstrate our greatness during the six-month period when we are likely to be surveyed? And if we look at it that way, perhaps that will give us a better perspective. So my first suggestion here is to develop a survey protocol. A survey protocol would be, say, a document that you create, maybe 2 to 3 pages long, written, that you provide to your registration staff and your administration, anybody that is going to come in contact with the surveyors during the very beginning part of the survey. So the survey protocol would list what to do when the surveyors arrive at the facility. So it'll answer questions like, where do you escort them? What do you say to them? Who you contact? And a list of all of those contacts. What are the first steps that you take as you're waiting as the surveyors are getting prepared to do the survey. So it'll list things like what type of documents, what binders do you get from their storage, bring them into the room for the surveyors to look at, printing a daily schedule, basically getting all of the things ready to demonstrate that you're fully ready to do a survey. When you have a survey protocol like this, and when you implement it, and when your staff follows through on everything that's on that survey protocol, it demonstrates an extreme level of organization, which will hopefully impress your surveyors. Also, that survey protocol should address issues like what are the different telephone numbers to contact the various individuals that need to be informed that a survey is going on? What to do if you can't get a hold of those individuals? What are your backup plans? What do you do if you can't get a hold of the administrator or the administrator is on vacation at that time? So that's my biggest suggestion, is always be prepared to have a survey protocol in front of the people that are likely to see a surveyor. And we should also point out that since a certified ambulatory surgery center is subject to a surveyor at any time, just not during that 3-year recertification survey, that you should probably have a survey protocol available at all times. What else should you be doing during that 3-month period? Well, certainly you need to keep up with everything that you should be doing anyway. So keep up with your meeting schedule. But make sure that when you're writing the minutes to those meetings that occur just before the survey, that you make it clear that those meeting minutes are not final yet, and that they're still in draft form until the next meeting, and at that point they become formal. That way the surveyors will understand that there's subject to correction based upon the reading of the minutes by the people that participated in the meeting. Keep up with identifying issues. Don't just stop doing your incident reports. Don't just stop doing all those things that you do on a regular basis anyway. It's far better for you to show that you know you have a problem and are actively working on a plan to fix it rather than have the surveyors identify it. So if during that time frame, during that 6-month time frame, something happens or you realize you're doing something incorrectly and need to rectify it, don't hide it. Just admit it, develop a plan, put it through your quality improvement program, demonstrate how you're actively working to rectify the situation, and in that way you'll demonstrate that you have an active and ongoing quality improvement program that's really serious. Remember, things do go wrong in an ambulatory surgery center. Nobody's perfect. It's normal to have issues during the normal course of events as you operate your ambulatory surgery center. It's how we react to it and how we document it and how we develop a plan to avoid it from happening again. That's important for a surveyor to see as part of their survey process. Also, make sure you keep up your training. Make sure that your staff are prepared to answer the questions and know the policies and procedures. It's always good to kind of continue to refresh everybody's memories about what the policies and procedures say. One of the common problems that we find during surveys is that the employees don't know the policies and procedures or haven't read them. Sometimes even the most basic policies and procedures, like what to do during a transfer of a patient to a hospital. And then obviously, you need to really watch those problem areas, especially sterile processing, hand hygiene, general cleanliness. Make sure that those areas are in particularly kept under close watch during that survey time frame. First impressions to a surveyor are very important. Make sure your waiting area is neat, that all the appropriate signage is up, that everything looks nicely organized, that the signs are posted appropriately, look nice, don't look worn out, are current, obviously. Make sure all of your staff are wearing the appropriate identification badges and are following all the requirements for personal protective equipment and sterile attire. Make sure that they're following the hand hygiene and hair covering requirements. Look at the outside of the building. Make sure that the outside appearance is looking good. All of these things will help you to really make a great first impression with the surveyors. Again, I think the biggest takeaway here is to never put yourself in a situation where you're rushing to get ready for a survey during that 6-month period where you're waiting for the survey to occur. put a process in place prior to the survey to check everything out in the year before the survey is expected, and go through a thorough review of all the conditions for coverage and all of the accreditation standards to make sure you're following through on everything. Make sure your policy manual is up to date. Make sure your training programs are up to date. Make sure everybody has been through that training. All of those things need to be done, and you need to follow through on a regular basis. My advice is to do a mock survey every year. You can either bring somebody in from outside, or you can do this yourself. What you want to do here is just for a day, set aside time to go through the entire organization and look at it with the eye of a surveyor. Try to determine what types of things a surveyor are likely to see during that mock survey that you're performing. And use this as an opportunity to learn and to improve everything that's going on. Always be prepared and make sure that you have a good survey protocol available so that the staff knows what to do when the surveyor shows up.
Thanks, John. This concludes episode 8. Join us next week for the ASC podcast with John Gailey. This podcast is an educational and operational tool and is not intended to be a comprehensive resource for all the rules, regulations, and standards that an ambulatory surgery center must meet. The advice provided should not be considered as, nor does it constitute, legal advice or opinion. When reviewing specific situations involving legal and regulatory issues, attorneys and other professionals should be consulted. This has been a production of Eden Group Development, all rights reserved. We would like to thank this week's sponsors, Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, one of the nation's leading regulatory compliance and financial oversight firms. For a free consultation, contact John Gailey today at 585-594-1167 or through email at info@ah-strategies.com. Our other sponsor today is Eden Group Development, which publishes ASC Regulatory Compliance Series, the ASC industry's leading books, including The Survey Guide for ASCs, a guide to the CMS conditions for coverage, and interpretive guidelines for ambulatory surgery centers, and Ambulatory Surgery Center Governance, a guide for ambulatory surgery center owners and governing body members. These must-have books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, or directly from the publisher at reg-books.com. That's reg-books.com. If you are interested in advertising or sponsoring the ASC podcast with John Gailey, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com. We would love to hear your questions and comments. Please email us at comments@ascpodcast.com.